Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Really, when we see that weather out there, it's bigger and badder and more impactful because of what we have done to it, that we've warmed it up.
We will terminate the Green News scam immediately.
Summer is 2 months early in Central Asia. The first 11 days in Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Kazakhstan were all above 30 degrees C or 86 Fahrenheit, a little bit early. But just listen to the harsh heat wave hitting India's capital, Delhi, and its 33 million people.
India's Delhi has fast-forwarded straight into peak summer this year. What's usually reserved for the sweltering months of May and early June has already gripped the capital in early April. With dry winds, rising humidity, and a full-blown heat wave, the temperatures crossing the 40 degrees Celsius mark, residents of Delhi are now facing a brutal preview of summer far earlier than expected. Delhi is officially in meltdown mode, quite literally. On the 7th of April, Delhi recorded its first official heat wave of the season, with the mercury peaking at a sizzling 40.2 degrees Celsius. This was the highest maximum temperature so far this year, surpassing the previous 39 degrees Celsius recorded just days ago on the 3rd of April.
So the summer season is here, and India's national capital, Delhi, is experiencing some pretty scorching temperatures. The temperatures are expected to soar to over 42 degrees Celsius by the 10th of April. The Indian Meteorological Department has forecast a very severe heat wave across the northern part of India in the coming days, which will drive up the mercury levels across the region. Now, the capital is expected to witness mainly clear skies with humidity levels peaking at about 45%. A hotter day lies ahead with minimum and maximum temperatures forecast at 23 degrees Celsius and 40 degrees Celsius.
Still don't care? How about the 100-degree day in Phoenix already, a month earlier than usual? That's a spring heat wave over the whole U.S. Southwest.
We start today with an early spring heat wave in the southwestern United States. We're only 8 days into spring, but it's starting to feel more like summer for some cities that are reaching record temperatures for this time of year. Phoenix, Arizona came just shy of hitting the 100-degree mark, reaching 99 this week. If they had reached the forecasted triple-digit temperature, it would have been their earliest 100-degree day on record based on National Weather Service data. Normally, the city averages its first 100-degree day on May 11th. In California, cities like Bakersfield and Sacramento City broke high temperature records that were set in 1997, reaching 91 and 88 degrees, respectively. The unusual warmth is also reaching the Pacific Northwest, where record high temperatures in Portland and Seattle are creating a rare thunderstorm threat that hasn't been seen this early in the year for at least three decades.
No matter what weather you experienced lately, according to Copernicus in Europe and the U.S. NOAA, the world had the warmest January ever recorded. It was 1.75 degrees C above the pre-industrial level. 18 of the last 19 months were over the alleged 1.5 degree safety line for climate change. We get the hottest months ever recorded on this planet, despite the La Niña conditions which normally cool things down. This is over-the-limit superheat, unless you are this guy.
The day I take office, we will terminate the Green News scam immediately. I will stop energy price hikes.
Donald Trump got elected promising cheap gas at the pumps. He would turn the USA into an energy superpower. Off with the protections and national parks. Drill by the beaches, frack by the schools, do whatever you want. Because they are firing the regulators and the scientists who measure this stuff and the prosecutors who enforce anything related to pollution, the protection of nature, or climate change. The artificial intelligence bros are scanning all government data to find anything related to climate change. They want to delete all that and fire the scientists who produce it. Or just fire scientists generally. Or get rid of the universities. Who needs those eggheads? need funeral music. The end of climate science in America may be nigh. That is not a fringe worry anymore. It is happening in real time. Paul Voosen holds a master's degree in science journalism from Columbia. On April 11th, he filed this story at science.org, the publication of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. The title is, Trump Seeks to End Climate Research at Premier U.S. Climate Agency. White House aims to end NOAA's research office. NASA also targeted. I'm just going to pass this on, reading from Voosen's article. President Donald Trump's administration is seeking to end nearly all of the climate research conducted by the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency, one of the country's premier climate science agencies, according to an internal budget document seen by Science. The document indicates the White House is ready to ask Congress to eliminate NOAA's climate research centers and cut hundreds of federal and academic climate scientists who track and study human-driven global warming. The administration is also preparing to ask for deep cuts to NASA's science programs, according to media reports today. The administration's plan would eliminate all funding for climate, weather, and ocean laboratories and cooperative institutes, says the document, which reflects discussions between NOAA and the White House Office of Management and Budget about the agency's 2026 budget request. Currently, NOAA operates 10 research labs around the country. They include influential ocean research centers in Florida and Washington State, 5 atmospheric science labs in Boulder, Colorado and Maryland, and a severe storm lab in Oklahoma. It also operates the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory in New Jersey, the birthplace of weather and climate modeling, as well as a lab in Michigan devoted to the Great Lakes. The agency further funds cooperative institutes, which support a large collection of academic scientists who work closely with the NOAA labs. The proposal would cut NOAA's Competitive Climate Research Grants Program, which awards roughly $70 million a year to academic scientists. It would end support for collecting regional climate data and information, often used by farmers and other industries, and it would terminate the agency's National Oceanographic Partnership Program and College and Aquaculture Sea Grant programs, which support a host of research efforts. NOAA officials still have time to persuade OMB to alter the request, but NOAA sources said it is unlikely to substantially change. But this proposal is only the first stage of the budget process. Congress will have the final word in setting NOAA's spending. At NASA, science programs also face severe cuts, according to details first reported by Ars Technica. The White House is considering requesting a nearly 50% cut to NASA's science office, down to an overall budget of $3.9 billion. According to Ars Technica, the plans call for a 2/3 cut to astrophysics, down to $487 million, a greater than 2/3 cut to heliophysics, down to $455 million, a greater than 50% cut to earth science, down to $1 billion, and a 30% cut to planetary science, down to $1.9 billion. Such NASA cuts would require ending the operations of a huge host of earth science satellites. They could also result in the closure of NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland, which has thousands of employees and is one of the agency's premier centers for earth science research. The cuts would also end plans for Mars sample return, the Da Vinci mission to Venus, and the Nancy Grace Roman Space Satellite Telescope, which is almost fully assembled. That is an end from a quote from Paul Voosen at science.org, with work from Eric Berger's report April 11th at arstechnica.com on the NASA cuts. Find links to all that in my show blog. You should read it. Close the Goddard Space Flight Center? Forget new Earth science satellites? Fire the biggest and possibly best climate science teams in the world?
What's that you see?
Nothing. Killing me.
Big storms, rooftops fly.
in the dark. Wiped out in waves, never seen coming. Dancing in their graves, machines still humming. Keyword search, delete, delete. Billionaire score, mission complete.
In the year 410, the Christian father St. Augustine kept a diary of his times. The German tribes known as the Vandals were storming across North Africa. They were at the gates of his ancient city of Carthage. Then he received impossible news. Rome itself was sacked. Augustine foresaw the ancient institutions of learning, government, and the arts crumbling away, leading to a long period now called the Dark Ages. Are we there yet? I don't think so. But we can smell burning institutions in America, once a light of democracy for the world. Big-name universities like Harvard and Princeton and Columbia are being defunded and told what to teach. Until now, the brightest students, scientists, and scholars came to those universities from around the world to learn and spread their brilliance. They have all been sent home, abruptly, with no warning. They find an email announcing an immediate cut to funding and told to self-deport. One scientist I follow on Blue Sky was followed in February, rehired a week ago, then fired again. Others have watched 5 or 10 years of research suddenly wiped out, along with their paychecks that paid the mortgage and their families. Big black holes of data are opening up in America, formerly the biggest bank of weather data and climate science anywhere. In recent weeks on this show, I asked guests from Europe and Australia whether climate science can be maintained and go forward without NASA or NOAA. In today's feature interview with the grand old man of Canadian weather and climate, I ask again, twice, because nobody, none of our guests, could take that seriously. After working this beat for decades, I see NASA and NOAA science in almost everything, and the new deniers plan to kill that off.
This Congress should enact a moratorium on the construction of any new coal-fired power plant.
On April 8th, Trump stands in front of some burly men who might be coal miners, and they look pretty strange, out of place in the Oval Office. He signed an executive order to boost the American coal industry. Trump wants a rash of new coal plants to fuel data farms for artificial intelligence. He's dumping any incentives to buy electric cars, removing any legislation requiring phasing out gas vehicles. The electric revolution is over, along with all that other green crap, he says. The new Environmental Destruction Agency fires any investigators and dump the pollution rules, so just go for it. The new Orwellian great leader says there is no climate change. Hey, that was all a scam. Wow, that's such a relief. Don't believe your lying eyes. Never mind the heat and all those bodies overseas. But disasters come again and again. David Jellies writes about climate economic disaster warnings for for the New York Times on April 10th. He notes a Morgan Stanley report expects the world to heat by 3 degrees Celsius. A UN GAP report also found the world likely to warm to 3.1 degrees C over pre-industrial by the end of this century. That means flooding of cities like Rio, Shanghai, and Miami, just to name a few. A February report from First Street found the U.S. would lose $1.47 trillion in lost real estate values by 2055, just 30 years from now. 80,000 homes would be lost to floods in the next 15 years in New York City, according to two reporters in the Times. Gunther Thallinger is a member of the supervisory board of a company called Allianz SE. It's a giant Swiss insurer. He told the Times, quote, "The math breaks down. The premiums required exceed what people or companies can pay. This is already happening. Entire regions are becoming uninsurable." But the risks extend well beyond the insurance business, Thallinger said. "This is not a one-off market adjustment," he wrote in his post. "This is a systematic risk that threatens the very foundation of the financial sector. If insurance is no longer available, other financial services become unavailable too. A house that cannot be insured cannot be mortgaged. No bank will insure loans for an uninsurable property. Credit markets freeze. This is a climate-induced credit crunch." End quote from David Jellies in the New York Times, April 10th. You think the stock market is melting down now? Wait until the real world melts too, and you won't have to wait long. So let's get to our feature guest with Canada's take.
Radio EcoShock.
The world's second largest country gets a lot of weather. For more than 40 years, Canadians heard about it from David Phillips. He was a senior climatologist for Environment Canada and spokesperson for the Meteorological Service of Canada. David is also a weather historian, and he's an author appearing on radio, television, and magazines. He's won many awards, including the Order of Canada. From Barrie, Ontario, David Phillips, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, Alex, thank you so much. Looking forward to chatting with you about a very important topic that is, maybe not so much in the news these days, but we seem to be focused more on economic issues. But boy, climate change and environmental change is still one of the most important environmental issues that humankind has ever faced, and we have a long ways to go to try to solve that.
Yes, we can worry about tariffs in the stock market, but we're still getting hit by ice storms and crazy heat in different places of the world. So, in recent months, I have seen dangerous weather roll across North America. It's blizzards and ice storms and tornadoes and flooding. Seems like every night on TV. You are a weather historian. You've published an annual summary since 1996. Is this just another spring, or are we entering a period of chaotic weather events?
Yeah, it's a tough question, you know, because what we don't necessarily keep track of, because every storm, every event is quite different and different character and different personality. And so, you know, there are hurricanes and there are hurricanes and there are snowstorms, and they could be hitting a rural area and causing problems for them, but hitting Toronto or Edmonton, that could create more chaos for people. So it's. I always think it's hard to compare one year with the next. It's almost a collection of extremes and various conditions, and you just sort of say, well, gee, you know, since a particular year for me, for example, it all began in 2021 when I think Canadians began to see that climate change was a threat to themselves, to their backyard, to their front yard, to their neighborhoods. Prior to that, Alex, it was all about climate change was an Arctic thing. It was about, you know, melting ice and permafrost, and it was about ice calving off ice caps into the ocean. It was about can't build ice roads. It's about skinny polar bears. And so people would say, well, I've seen examples of it, and I've read about it and seen documentaries on it. But boy, in 2021, for the vast majority of millions of Canadians in the South, it sort of hit home that this wasn't something that, my gosh, occurs on the other side of the world, either in the Arctic or in Bangladesh or Botswana or Bolivia. My gosh, it's occurring in Burlington and Brandon and Burnaby. I mean, we're seeing this in our own settlements, and I think that had an enormous effect on Canadians. And we saw it as extremes of weather, quite variable. It was storms we had never seen before, really, and impactful. And so many elements of that seemed to change, and I think that this is when Canadians became aware of the threat. You know, before that, it was sort of, well, you know, I'm concerned about climate change, but probably more interested in my barbecue on the weekend than I am about climate change. I mean, I'll be safely dead before that begins to bite deep and hard. But as something that was futuristic was now seen as more present, and I think that really shook Canadians up. And I see, certainly, from surveys done of Canadians, that's when they really began to think that, hey, this climate change was a real thing. It was not futuristic. It was happening now. It wasn't not just for my grandchildren. It was happening to certainly today. And so I think there was a big change for that. Now, this year, I mean, I look back over the last few months, and we certainly came out of an El Nino from last year, and we're into a La Nina for this winter, and that has produced some differences. This El Nino, the warm pool of water in the tropical Pacific, and it was sort of dead in the water, and then, boy, it took a long while for the La Nina, the cold phase, to come in, but it eventually sort of did. So I think that was a situation we saw last winter. Was almost, I've often said, well, we've canceled a few summers in Canada, but never winters. Well, winter of last year, we had the warmest winter in Canada, warmest worldwide, certainly the warmest winter in Canada. It felt like everybody said, well, gee, it was more like a Vancouver winter across the country, with snowfall totals down, more fog, less more rain than snow, and again, warmer, warmer, warmer. And so this year was more kind of it certainly was a lot colder, particularly in the last half of winter, more snowy. So I think we've seen these variations, this wildness, this wackiness with the weather. But I don't think it's necessarily all of a sudden changed this year. I just think that we get periods where we see a lot of active weather, and other times where things seem to be a bit quiet. So it's hard to say that this is a fluctuation or a trend. It's just the way that the weather works, and it can be wild at one time and less so at the other. But when you plot it and look at it and graph it and look at it statistically, there's clearly evidence that we're seeing more of these things, that yes, you might not see it one year, you see it another year, but when you average it over a period, look at that trend, squint your eyes and tilt your head, you see clearly a trend that's upward. Not only warmer conditions, clearly the jury's concluded on that, but whether there's wild, wild weather, I think there's certainly a lot of evidence to suggest that is the case, but not necessarily to the way you could predict that this year is going to be worse than last year.
Environment Canada also warned that extra climate heat might hide in warmer night temperatures. Has that played out?
Well, in a way it has. I think really that is really what the real sort of evidence of climate change, global warming, is in terms of temperatures. And we've seen certainly the temperatures have gone up, although what is sort of interesting is that the real, you know, and I can give you all kinds of examples of why this is not the case. I'm going to misspeak now when I said, well, gee, we haven't seen the warm temperatures exceedingly warm now as we did in the past. And my gosh, in 2021, we broke an all-time record for Canada. The previous record was 45 degrees back in 1937. And in 2021, in the last couple of days of June into July, we saw a little place called Lytton, British Columbia, which had broke Canadian records for 3 days in a row, and the fourth day it burned down at least a good chunk of the town, and we saw temperatures that rocketed up there to 49.6 degrees, average rounded up to 50 degrees. I mean, that is incredible for the second coldest country in the world. I mean, this is warmer than any place in the United States outside of the desert Southwest, warmer than Las Vegas and Phoenix, warmer than any temperature in centuries in Europe, and warmer than any temperature ever seen in South America. I mean, here, we are a cold country. We're known as the Great White North, a land of ice and snow, and yet we can brag about the fact that we've recorded a temperature that many parts of the world have never seen. But I think it's the nighttime temperatures that have me worried more than anything. Because, Alex, when you look at nighttime temperatures and you look at the impact of that, and that is through deaths, mortality and morbidity statistics, that clearly it's the nighttime temperatures. Now, the nighttime temperature may not be as warm as the daytime temperature, but, you know, there are not as many cooling centers open at night. Ventilation drops, so the air circulation is less, and you can't go to theaters and movies and at 3 in the morning. And so what we find with heat waves around the world, whether it be in Europe or in Asia or even in our own country in Canada, I think about 2021 or that heat dome over British Columbia and Alberta, I think the most shocking statistic of all was not that we broke a new record for Canada, but we saw the deaths from that. 600 people in British Columbia died during that 10 days of scorching temperatures, and 80 people in Alberta. I mean, you know, we normally set up a royal commission when 3 people die from a heat wave, and I think people are still numbed and clearly pained by that. And a lot of the people were poorer people, were ill anyways, and had difficult time and were living alone, and so it really did show how vulnerable we are to warmer temperatures. And fortunately, we've seen some warm temperatures since then, but we have not seen the deaths because we learned from that.
And I'm hearing more about weather whiplash. For example, a rainy period encourages plant growth, and that is followed by a sudden drought, and then high temperatures and possibly wildfires. I remember Canada's premier fire scientist, Michael Flanagan, told us that the thin soils in the northern boreal forest only take about 3 days of dry heat to create fire-ready conditions. Is whiplash real? Are you seeing it, David Phillips?
Well, you know, it certainly was a word I wouldn't have used, say, 10 years ago. But I think it sort of became in vogue about, I think, 2017. I began to see reference to it. And you know, it made sense to me. I mean, I can give you examples of weather whiplash. I think there are actually a few more now than that. Maybe people are more in tune to the word and then are more looking at it. But you've given some really good examples. One that, and I think in some way, Alex, it's I would define it or separate it out between weather whiplash and sort of climate whiplash. Now, and it's not referring to, you know, a cold front, warm front moving in or a sea breeze and a land breeze where you can get temperatures from one day to the next. These are generally kind of changes that you have in almost in a weather state from over a larger region, maybe part of a continent, and so some examples. Let me share some examples. I think this maybe to your listeners will kind of emphasize what is really meant by weather whiplash. I remember in Manitoba, southern Manitoba, in 2023, that March and April were the two coldest March and Aprils they've ever had. In March, there wasn't a temperature in Winnipeg, for example, that got above freezing. And that is the first time in 125 years that's occurred. So that was cold March and April. Then we came to May-June, and we had the warmest May-June on record. Never have there been a 2 months of May-June together in a century and a quarter that have ever been warmer. So think about that. You went from slush to sweat on May 1st. I said that spring lasted 6 days that particular year. So you went from one state of brutally cold to one of incredibly warm. And to me, that's a really good example of what we talk about in terms of weather whiplash. And I remember, certainly I've mentioned the 2021 episode in British Columbia, and I remember that particular period there were very hot, very dry, with forest fires, and it changed the landscape of British Columbia. soil, the vegetation was burnt, the ground was blackened, and then when the